Hi, I'm an alcoholic, a member of the Fifth Tradition Group in Scarborough, Ontario, and my name's Jay Albee. Hi, everyone. I'd like to thank Jim and John for giving me the privilege and the honor of speaking here this morning, because I do believe it's a privilege and an honor, because everything good and decent in my life today is because of Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God that I found through you people. So I'm very grateful to be here. Happy Father's Day to everyone that's a father out there. I know that for me it's a day that for 12 years I didn't talk to my dad before I came into the program, and I don't really say this much, but today I get to take care of my dad, take care of my father, and the last 20 years of it's been healing, right? So I'm very grateful for that. Anyway, 1992 was the first time that I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was some charges, and they wanted me to go to treatment. Now, I didn't want to go to treatment. I didn't want to say I was alcoholic, much less accept spiritual help. And to be honest with you, the only reason I went, it was for my mom. My mom begged me to go, and I end up going. But at that time, I think that literature talks about deep down, every man, woman, child is a fundamental idea of God. It's blocked by calamity, pulp, and worship of things. And that time, there was a lot of things I worshipped: alcohol, women, power, prestige. And not till I came in here, I couldn't understand, because I did have, I'm not here to tell you it was all doom and gloom. I had a lot of fun with alcohol, but I couldn't understand that. At times I felt like I was regaining control, and those intervals were usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control. But when I came here, not till I started to do the work, and I started to go through There's a Solution, and it talks about the moderate drinker. He can take it or leave it alone. How about the hard drinker? Sufficient reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or wanting of a doctor becomes imperative. They can stop or moderate. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. That's what happened to me. I became a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of my drinking career, I began to lose all control of my liquor consumption when I started. And that really, really made sense to me. So lack of power was my dilemma. And what do? I get up every morning and I connect to God, and I thank God for grace. I thank God for prosperity. I thank God for health. I thank God for mercy. I thank God for the beautiful family that I belong to. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God for gratitude. And when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I belonged to a group with a lot of long term sobriety, and they told me that gratitude is an action. Don't tell me how grateful you are. Show me how grateful you are that I've been a user and a taker all my life, and that takers lose in life and givers win. So you make up your mind what you want to do. And it's my experience, and that's all I'm going to share from the front of the room, is that the more I give, the more I get. And it's not a material thing. It's not the new girlfriend. It's not the new car. It's not the new house. What it does for me, see, I'm enough the way I stand before you here today. So it really doesn't matter if I drive a Ferrari or I take a bus. It really doesn't matter to me today if I have a piece of bread with a tomato or I eat a steak. Really doesn't matter to me when I walk into a room what people think about me. I don't measure myself on a better and less than basis. And the more I'm sober, the more I realize that's the gift that God, Alcoholics Anonymous, and sobriety has given me, that I'm enough. Anyway, my sponsor used to say that there's three things you should do when you get in front of the room, is be yourself, do your best, and practice the presence of God. And that's what I'm going to try to do here tonight for the next half an hour. So my life has been brought to a place of daily surrender. My life has been brought to a place of acceptance, mindfulness, presentness, not attached to yesterday, not attached to tomorrow, but present with breath, with you, and with God. It was never like that. I was always in yesterday, and when things work out tomorrow, I'll be okay. And our literature, it talks about God doesn't make hard turns for those who seek Him. time when I'm living present right now in this room, turns aren't hard for me. It's when my mind will get involved. And that's what happened because alcohol had destroyed the love of my family. It had destroyed the love of my friends. It took my ambition. It took my self-respect. It took every love, every dream that I ever had. You know, I had the morals of an alley cat, and my soul was black as the ace of spades. But by coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and doing all 12 steps and growing in understanding and effectiveness and enhancing the spiritual experience that God has given me, it has erased, it has dissolved a lot of those things. Today I'm a son, today I'm a brother, today I'm an uncle, today I'm a friend. Today I have loves, today I have dreams, but when it comes to alcohol, I'm insane, and I don't need the 20 questions to tell me I'm an alcoholic, believe me. Once I pick up a drink of alcohol, I have little or no control over the amount that I drink, and my life revolves around the next drink. I have a drink in this hand, and I'm not worried about that drink. I'm worried, how am I going to get my next one? And I lie. I cheat, I steal, I manipulate, I do whatever I have to do to get that next drink into me. And one of the definitions of insanity is to believe a lie, something that's not true. And every morning I'd wake up and I'd say, there's no way I'm going to drink this morning. And you could connect me to a lie detector test and I would have passed that test because with every fiber in my body and with all my heart, I didn't want to pick up that drink. And then my imagination would be in conflict with my will. And when imagination is in conflict with will, imagination wins all the time, and the switch would go off. And I start thinking, you know, what my father did to me 30 years ago, what this person did to me 15 years ago, what this person did to me 10 years ago, what this person said to me last week, what this person said to me last night. And the next part of my day would be I'd be getting even with people. And from there, I'd be looking for people to piss me off. And if you didn't piss me off, I knew exactly what you're thinking about me. I was full of hate, anger, resentment. From resentment, I went into self-resentment. From self-resentment, I went into self-pity. And from self-pity, I went into self-hate. I could not stand myself. By the time I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was full of shame, remorse, guilt. I was irritable, restless, and discontent. And the only thing that gives me a false sense of ease and comfort is by picking up a drink. I need the relief right away. And I understand today that I was suffering from a spiritual malady. And I remember being new, asking my sponsor, like, what's this spiritual malady? And he said, Jay, right now your spirit is asleep, and this is how you feel when you don't have alcohol or God in your life. I was having trouble with my relations. I couldn't control my emotional natures. I was a prey to misery and depression. I couldn't make a living. I had a feeling of uselessness. I was full of fear. I was unhappy. I couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. And that's exactly how I felt. And what's happened to me as a result of the 12 steps is my spirit has awakened. I've had a change in personality through time, sufficient enough for me to recover from alcoholism. I've changed the way I feel. I've changed the way I think. My attitude and outlook on life, people, place, and things. I'm not the same person that came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous just over 20 years ago. And thank God. Anyway, I grew up in the East End of Toronto. I'm the oldest of four kids. I grew up in an Italian family. And to be blunt, growing up, I hated my father. My father always told me I was stupid. I was good for nothing. I never amount to anything. And as a kid growing up, I believe that. I remember going to school and the teachers would ask the kids, you know, what do you want to become? And the kids would say, you know, I want to become a doctor. I want to become a lawyer. I want to become a hockey player. I didn't want to become none of those things because I was paralyzed in fear and I had no self-esteem. And that's what alcohol did for me. I'm not one of these guys. I picked up a drink. I felt taller. I felt better looking, or I felt like I could dance when I picked up a drink of alcohol. I just felt normal and I needed more alcohol and I got less and less of that feeling. I understand today I still drank for the effect produced by alcohol. See, I could come into a room like this. I'd be paralyzed in fear. My stomach would be in knots. I feel awkward and out of place, and I can go into my kitchen, have two or three drinks, and walk back outside and feel like I belong. Same room, same people. Without alcohol, I cannot stand to be in this room. And I do not drink because what happened to me as a kid. I do not drink because of my environment. I do not drink because of the things I've done to people and the things people have done to me. I drink because I like the effect produced by alcohol. It changes my perception of reality. Anyway, growing up, like I said, I grew up in the East End of Toronto, and Growing up, my dad used to have a supermarket. It's on Pape and Danforth. And when I wasn't going to school, I'd work there midnights with my uncle. And my uncle's friends used to come around that night. And they were much older than me. They never worked. They always had women with them. And I was attracted to these guys. Now, here's the insanity. In the 1970s, my father has a $1 million business. And I'm thinking, what a loser. And I'm thinking people respected those people. I understand today, people just feared those people. And people respected a person like my dad. And going through my inventory, I understand today they were my first addiction. I like the effect produced by them. Again, power, prestige. By the age of 16, I had, I seen a lot of things and I did a lot of things that no 15, 16-year-old kid should see do affected my life immensely. By the age of 16, I had two brand new Cadillacs, all the material things one can have. And I'm not telling that to impress you. I'm telling you that 20 years ago in February, 2 days before I went into treatment, I broke into my mom's home and I stole their checkbook. My mother, who I would jump in front of a car for, I would tear out my heart for my mother, and you put a drink of alcohol on me, and I do not care. I'm like a bulldozer. I'll bulldoze over anybody to get that next drink into me. And I didn't understand then, which I understand today, that I was beyond human aid. See, no matter how much I love my mother, I can't stop. My brother telling me, hey, if you pick up one more drink, you're not going to be able to see your niece. I'm on bail. Part of my bail stipulation is I cannot consume alcohol. And you know what I do. You're starting to get to know me. At that time, I'm beginning to develop that particular mental twist, and I have a strange mental blank spot. See, I can't bring a sufficient force into my consciousness. The suffering and humiliation of a day, a week, or a month ago, I was without defense against the first drink, and I didn't even know it. Anyway, the first trouble that I did get into alcohol. With alcohol, I used to hang around the social club in the east end of Toronto, and I got drunk one night. I was being loud, obnoxious, and they said, you know, Jay, you should go home and sleep it off. And I called a friend of mine, and we were driving along Woodbine and Girard again in the east end of Toronto, and we hit a guy and we killed him. And I'll never forget, he came into the glass, and I was covered in all little pieces of glass. And the first thing that came to my head, I don't use foul language from the podium, but the first thing that came to my head was, what a so-and-so. You know, he ruined my pants, self-centered to the extreme. And not till I was about 3 months sober, it was Mother's Day, and I couldn't look at my mom. These feelings were starting to pop up. And I remember phoning my sponsor saying, like, what's the matter with me? I feel no remorse. I have feelings. He said, Jay, your whole life, your feelings and your emotions, you've been boxing them up inside. And right now, you're like a ravine full of junk and dirt. As you go along, you do your 12 steps, you're going to pick up that junk and that dirt. And if anything falls in there, you're going to pick it up and take it out. And he was talking about again, the 12 steps of alcohol. One of the reasons why I couldn't look at my mom, his mother, his father, his brothers, and his sisters were across the street in the restaurant watching. His father came running across the street. He's holding his son. Blood's coming out of his mouth, blood's coming out of his ears, and he's crying, you know, son, please don't die. And that was my thinking. Anyway, I end up opening my own social club in the east end of Toronto, and I thought I had arrived. And there was an attempt made on my life. They threw a bomb through my front window, and by the grace of God, I got away. And it was in all the newspapers, the news in Toronto, that me and my partners were known to police. And here's the kicker, right? My whole life revolves around what you think about me. So what did I do? I went and opened up across the street from where they bombed me because I couldn't show you that I was scared. And meanwhile, I was paralyzed in fear. It could have been one out of a 1,000 people that did it. And the only solution I have to that fear is by picking up a drink of alcohol. And not till I remember listening to my sponsor. See, my whole life revolves around what you think about me. I don't care if you live or die. It really doesn't make a difference to me. I need your approval. And at home, I have my family's approval. And I'm a user and taker of people. And the people I use and take from the most is my family, because I'm fortunate. I come from the type of family. My mother was an enabler. My mother loved the son the way a mother should love a son. And she kept giving, and I kept taking. She kept giving, and I kept taking, saying, finally, maybe Jay's going to get it. Till finally, I broke her heart, and she said, you know, Jay, you're no longer welcome here. And for my mother to do that, you know what it took. And we talk in our meetings about treating your family like friends and friends like family. I didn't even treat my family like friends. I was the type of person, We had an ice storm here years ago. My mom could phone me and say, "Listen, we need milk." I'd say, "Leave me alone." Phone my brother, and you could phone me and say, "Listen, we got to go to Montreal," and I'd say, "Come pick me up." And I had distanced myself so far from my family at this is at 2, 3 years sober. My brother, his wife ended up having twins, and I had to baptize one of the girls, and I had to take a picture with my own sister, and to put my arm around my own sister, it felt like an eternity. And thank God it's not like that today. Anyway, I'm going to take you right near the ending of my drinking. What happened was one of my best friends was on the run, and he was in Florida, and I used to go quite a bit back and forth to Florida, and I went to see him down there, and I asked him if he wanted to go out for a drink, and he told me he doesn't drink anymore. Now, I don't know if he was in a 12-step program, but what happened was a short time later, he ended up coming back to Toronto, I guess making amends. He ended up going to the penitentiary, and years later, after getting out of the penitentiary, he was a mess again. And I used to be in the bar business, and he had opened up a bar in the area where I grew up, and I was in Florida, and I got home, and he asked me if I wanted to go out for a drink, and I told him that I'd meet him, but be up 3, 4 days drinking and using alcohol in other forms. And what happened was I fell asleep. Now, my sister owns a flower shop on the Danforth, and I got a phone call from my sister the next morning that he had hung himself. His brother found him hanging, and a short time later, his kid found his brother with a needle in his arm, overdose. Talk about explosion. What happened to me was I imploded. I began to go crazy. Where I come from, you don't talk about stuff like that. And in my head, I said, even if I say something to somebody, they might have thought that I was involved. And what happened is I began to go crazy. My partners, I had another place in Markham, Ontario. It's a quiet town, and my partners thought it'd be best for me to go out there. But out there, it was worse because there was nobody there to watch me. On top was like a cafe, and on the bottom was like a banquet hall. And I just go downstairs and drink myself to oblivion. And what happened is now my body's starting to shut down. I'd be walking along the street. Blood was coming everywhere possible it could come out of, and I went to see a doctor. Now, the doctor asked me if I was drinking or using drugs. Of course, I'm a liar. I said no, and he wanted me to go do some tests. Now, on my fourth step inventory, on my fear list is cancer. My mother's a cancer survivor. I've lost all my aunts and uncles to cancer. 90% of them. I've lost all my grandparents to cancer. And in my head, from the paranoia, I began to convince myself that I was dying from cancer. And I began to isolate from everybody. And people were saying, like, "Listen, Jay, you're not dying." And I couldn't comprehend anything. And my father, who I hadn't talked to in, like I said, 12 years, he came to my house and he said, "Son, I love you. Please get some help." And I told him to get the F out of my house because it was all his fault. If he had a father like mine, if what happened to me happened to you, you'd be the same, a victim. And my poor dad was supposed to leave to go on holidays, and he didn't want to leave because he didn't know if he'd find me dead or alive. And I can't. Every time I say this, I can't even believe I did this. We have a hospital here, Sunnybrook Hospital in Toronto. It's a cancer hospital, and I took my mom and my best friend there, and I walked into that hospital, and I said, "Start the chemo on me," because I thought I was dying. And my mom's crying, my best friend saying, like, "Listen, man, we got to get you out of here," and I can't comprehend anything. And now my partners are starting to get fed up. I'm not showing up for work. Money's starting to go missing. Other things are starting to go missing. And it was Super Bowl Sunday, February 6, 2005. And they said, "We're going to have a little party." And it's my remember when. And I know today it was tough love. I walked in, and I got beat by pool balls, and I was laying on the floor. The relief went through my body. I thought I was gonna die, and I said, "Thank God I don't have to live like this anymore." And they picked me up, and they cleaned me up, and they said, "Jake, You better get some help, or next time you won't be so lucky. And my partners weren't the type of people you messed around. One had been in Kingston Penitentiary for shooting a guy 5 times in the head, and the other had been in the penitentiary for trafficking cocaine. As they were beating me, they were crying, and they said, "Jay, why can't you stop?" And I gave the first honest answer that I'd given in a long time. I said, "I don't know," and they assured me that I better get some help. And the only reason I believe I'm here today is because they knew me as a kid, and they knew my uncles, because I've seen a lot worse happen to people for a lot less. Now, for years, I said, "How could my friend Tony hang himself?" And here I am in the middle of my living room with a gun in my mouth, wanting to blow my head off. And I never, never want to forget the loneliness, the self-hate, the hopelessness I felt that day. I never, never want to forget that. And when I used to speak, I used to say that I was too much of a coward to pull the trigger. And there was a long timer in my first home group, George, and he says, "Jay, it pisses me off when you say that." He says, "Do you think maybe it wasn't an act of providence? And looking back on my journey, I understand what happened to me. See, I was touched by the unseen hand of God. See, I didn't find God in religion. I didn't find God in the church. I didn't find God in the church basement. Actually, I didn't find God at all. God found me on the middle of that floor on February 6, 2005. And this is what he said: 'Jay Albee, that's enough. And here's what I'm going to do for you. If you do for you what's possible, I will do for you the impossible.' On February 7th, 2005, a loving God separated me from alcohol. I was a full-blown alcoholic addict. I was suffering from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If I live to be 100 years old, I'll never look as old as the day that I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me from that scrap heap and he placed me before you here today, recovering from a hopeless condition of mind and body with some dignity, experiencing the glory of God. I get to give it back to newcomers, and I walk with my head high and shoulders square because of the power of God that I found in the sacred rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. On February 6, 2005, my life revolved around the next drink. Every time I pick up a drink, the craving intensifies, and I'm never satisfied, and I have a mind that wants to kill me. My mind insists that I pick up that drink, no matter the consequences of the day before, the month before, the doctors, the jails, the institutions. My mind insists that I pick up that drink, and I believe that day, a loving God, he planted a mustard seed of willingness to change. And with a mustard seed of willingness, you can move a mountain. And that was the day I didn't want to live that life or die. And God rocked me to where I am today. And I'm very, very grateful. And my best friend and my sister came over and they said, "Jay, will you accept some help?" And I said, "Yeah." Now, I don't know if there's any new people on the screen, but if you don't want to be here, that's okay, because this was the last place that I wanted to be. I hope I never have a bigger spiritual experience than I did on February 7th, 2005. How can you take someone for over 20 years, 25 years? I cannot stop drinking or using mind-altering substance, and I haven't had a drink since. How's that happen? I'll tell you for me how it happened. See, I recover from the 12 steps, but two long-timers practicing their principles in their home, occupations, and affairs changed my life forever. I've never been the same since that day, and I'll get to that in a bit. So what happened was, I went to a treatment center in Brooklyn, Ontario, and it was a 12-step based treatment center. And they took us to meetings every day. We did the big book, 12 and 12. They talked about sponsorship, they talked about praying. And I should mention this story. So when I went in there, the counselors were all alcoholics and drug addicts, and so you weren't getting anything by them. And we were in a table. There was like tables all around, and the counselor was on the front chair, and he asked the first guy, he says, "How you feeling?" The guy says, "Okay." He goes, "Okay, that's not a feeling." And he made the guy start crying. Now, I don't like talking as it is. And he's going around the room and people are choking up, and he's getting to me. So we had like a workbook, and on this workbook, I had all these faces, right? And so he gets to me. So you got to picture this. I got two black eyes. My nose is partially broken, my lips out to here, and I got a lump on the side of my head. And he says, "How are you feeling?" I says, "Optimistic." So he didn't believe me at all. He didn't believe me. And what happened was, I did two things in that treatment center that I hadn't done in a long time. The first thing was, It was in February, and it was on a farm. And I remember looking at the trees, and there was snow on all the trees. And I go, man, I go, look how beautiful that looks. And I realized that I'd been living in the dark for a long, long time. And the second thing that I did was I laughed. I couldn't remember the last time I laughed. And I got out of there, and this is where my life changed forever. I've never been the same since that day. I live on Bellamy Road, and there's a my first home group was called the Bellamy Group, and it was a group. And thank God, every day I thank God, it was a group that long-term sobriety, and I got the tail end of that group. So I walk in this meeting, and there was a gentleman, Andy S. He was a founding member, and Ron D. He had been around for years. And Andy, I guess he knew I was new, and he said, in Toronto we have slogans, and there's a slogan that says keep an open mind. And he says, you know what that means, son? I said, no, it means keep your mouth shut. If you don't understand, ask, because you got nothing we want. And I'm like, okay, no problem. And he used to say, Jay, it's going to take you 5 years before you know your name. And in my head, I said, this guy must have been a real drunk. It took him 5 years before he knew his name. But after a while, I understood what he meant. And the newcomers would come in, and I'd say, you know, how's your day going? And they would complain. And I'd put my arm around them, and I'd say, you think you're having a bad day? You see that guy over there? It took him 5 years before he knew his name. And they would start to laugh, and he would start to laugh. And see what he did. See, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. And if I don't get rid of it, it's not going to hurt me. It's going to kill me. And what he did, see, he made me a good listener. When I'm listening to you, I'm not thinking about me. I'm out of self. And Ron D changed my life forever. I've never been the same since this day. He said, son, if you want guaranteed sobriety, you got to get on your knees in the morning. I don't care what God you pray to. Ask for help. Contact somebody in AA, and at night give thanks, and you had your last drink. And that was on a Monday. And this is how God begins to work for me. So I talk a lot about God. This isn't a religious program, it's a spiritual program. Religion means you must believe in God. Spirituality means it doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you're willing to believe in something. So what's God to me? Patience, tolerance, love, compassion, goodwill towards my fellow man, non-judgmental, non-punishing, the energy of love. So when I talk about God, it's just for me, it's the energy and love. And this is how God begins to work in my life. Like I said, I was in treatment in Brooklyn, and they gave me an old meeting book. And we have a church, St. Paul's Church, in downtown Toronto. And the church was under renovation. And I got to the church, and I started getting the compulsion, like I wanted to drink. And I walked downstairs, I walked into the church, and I said, you know, do you have a meetings here? And they said, I'm sorry, we don't have meetings here anymore. And I remember what that gentleman said, and I walked up, and I walked into the church, and I got on my knees, and I said, God, whoever you are, whatever you are, please help me. And I got the relief that I needed. And I used to get days where I used to feel like putting my head through a wall. And I go into public washrooms, and I get on my knees, and I'd say, God, whoever you are, whatever you are, please help me. And I always got the relief that I needed. And I'm not a professional on the big book or the 12 steps, but I believe that day I did my first 3 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I was beaten to the point. If there was a crack hole in the wall that I could have crawled through, I would have crawled through it. Nobody on the face of this earth wanted anything to do me with me, nor let me add, nor should they. Right? And step two talks about being reborn. I began to be reborn in my mind. I began to let old ideas out and new ideas in. And how do you do that? Through true humility and an open mind. And that day I made a decision to turn my will and my life. My will is my thinking, my life and my actions over to the, and this was the magic word for me. When I came in, I started to go, here we go here with the passing the basket. And I thought it was control. And I had a sponsor that made me get a dictionary. And he says, I want you to look up the word control, and I want you to look up the word care. And see, God, I know today God loves me. He doesn't want to control me. He cares about me. And that day in that church, I went looking for God. That day I found a need for God. And in literature, it talks about at certain times, the alcoholic has have no mental defense against the first drink. Neither he nor any human being could provide that defense. That defense, not could, not should, must come from a higher power. And that day, without even knowing it, I began to build a defense against the first drink. And that was on a Tuesday. And Sunday, we have a big men's meeting in Toronto. And at that time, it was like maybe 250, maybe 300 men. It was like huge. And I walk into this meeting, and the guy speaking was a friend of mine, Rick. The last time he drank, he was at the social club. I had to help him to his wife was waiting, and he was sober 18. I'm not good with dates. 18, 19 years, and he was the speaker. And 18, 19 years, he's only been to that meeting twice. Once when he first got sober, and years later, because he was speaking. I look over. There's a friend of mine, Michael. Michael had been charged for first degree murder. Had spent half of it in the penitentiary, and he was there. And there was another friend of mine, Carmen. Carmen, I knew him as a kid. I knew his father. I knew his brother. And all four of us knew each other, and nobody knew that they were going to be there. And for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I identified. They had working knowledge of the big book. They were practicing their principles in their home, occupations, and affairs. And I wanted to talk war stories, and they said, "Jay, we don't live like that anymore." At the end of that meeting, right, like I can really relate to Bill's story when I seen them, when he seen Abe, there was something different about them. Their eyes were shining, their skin was glowing. And then at the end of that meeting, you know what they said to me? They said, "Jay, I love you." And I cringed because I couldn't believe that anybody could love me. And every day they used to phone me, and every day at the end of that phone call would be, "Jay, I love you." And that's where Alcoholics Anonymous begins for me. You can ask anybody that knows me. My home group meets on Monday, on Tuesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. And every Tuesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, I'm at that front door with a hug, an open heart welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Michael gave me the keys to the kingdom that day. He said, in a letter, it talks about, for me, I came in, it took me 3 months just to clear out my brain. It says it's imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached. He has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. And this is what Michael told me. He said, "I want you to go to meetings, and I want you to sit in the front row, and I want you to listen for the similarities, not the differences in the way people feel, the way people think, the way people drink, their progression in alcoholism, and their drinking for oblivion, and how they get better. And maybe if you can identify, it's the beginning of belief and it's the beginning of hope." And what happened to me was through your shame, through your remorse, through your guilt, through your dishonesty, through your selfishness, through your self-centeredness, my spirit began to connect with your spirit. And this is the fellowship of the spirit, not the spirit of the fellowship. And two things happened to me. The first thing is that I learned a new language, and it's the language of the heart. And if it's not the language of the heart, my dear friends, it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. And the second thing that happened to me was I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly, truly love Alcoholics Anonymous with all my heart, because I know I've been given the gift, and the gift is the gift of hopelessness. See, I never forget the way I felt on February 6, 2005, on the middle of that floor. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've entered the world of the spirit. See, I'm safe and protected. Whatever happens to me, I'm going to be okay. Because Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't just save lives, it transforms lives. So you can say, go out and save and transform other people's life. And when I came in here, I remember saying, "My life's over. What am I going to do on Christmas? What am I going to do on New Year's? What am I going to do on my birthday? What am I going to do if I get married? I can't go to parties anymore, and nightclubs." And this was my party. I used to lock myself in a hotel room for about 3 days and peel out the window, and that was the party I was going to miss. And a friend of mine looked up party in the dictionary, and it means an event with more than one person. So that was the party that I was gonna miss. And what happened was, about 3 months sober, I started to feel better. I started to feel hate better. I started to feel anger better, and I was defrosting. And that's when My sponsors started to work the big book with me, and this was a pivotal moment for me. He opened up the book and he says, "I want to ask you a question." Jay says, "What's that?" He says, "What happens to you after you pick up a drink? Do you feel shame, remorse, and guilt?" I go, "Yeah." "Do you steal, lie, and manipulate?" "Yeah." "Do you make false promises?" "Yeah." "Do you drink more than you intended to drink?" "Yeah." "Do you hurt your family?" "Yeah." "Do you isolate? Do you feel loneliness? Do you feel depression?" "Yes." "Do you make false promises?" "Yes." And he went through a list about 30 things, and he says, "I want to ask you a question." He says, "See, the insanity in the 12 steps," he says, "Jay, it only talks about alcohol in the first step. It talks about being restored to sanity, complete wholeness of mind." And he says, "Here's the insanity, Jay. Look at these 30 things, and you pick up a drink, stone cold, sober, knowing these things are going to happen to you." He had me razzled. He goes, why do you pick up a drink?" He says, I says, "The way I feel." He says, "The way you feel, look at the consequences." And I went through a list of things, and finally I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Good answer." And he drew a circle, and he says, "This is what happens to you, Jay. You get a thought, that thought turns into a mental obsession. This is how you think. I'm just gonna buy Mickey. Today's Wednesday. I'll just finish the week. I'll start fresh on Monday. I'm having a good day. I'm having a bad day." And then he says, "You have your maladjustments to life, and you pick up that first drink. It sets off the allergy." I said, "An allergy?" He goes, "Yeah." I go, "I don't break out in a rash." And he says, "An allergy means an abnormal reaction to any liquid, food, or substance." He says, "When you pick up a drink, your brother, he's not alcoholic. His body says, don't give me any more. Your body says, keep giving me more." And then the phenomenon craving develops. I go through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to do it again. And I repeat that over and over unless I can experience entire psychic change. And this is what he said. "Here's a promise, Jay." He says, "On the other hand, as strange as it may seem, when the psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, he had so many problems and he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort necessary is to follow a few simple rules. Are you ready to follow those few simple rules?" And I said, "Yeah." And that's where I haven't got time to get into it, but that's where my life began to change. And I'm a big believer in the fellowship too. I believe the steps is the treatment, and I believe the fellowship is the environment for it to grow, right? And I'm a big believer in that. So I got 10 minutes here, so I'm just this is just my experience I'm going to share, right? So there's 3.5 million people in AA. There's 3.5 million different stories, and at the core of the story is always the same. I went to treatment 10 times, in and out of the room for years. What do you call it? I had 2 years, and then I went back out, and the core of the story has never changed for me. And finally got a sponsor. I did the steps to the best of my ability, which is never perfect. I have a home group. I go to meetings. I pray. I help other alcoholics. I do service, and I'm as honest as I can. And people do get, people don't, and it's just that simple, right? And I'm gonna just close with this story, I guess. It's Father's Day, I guess, and I'm very fortunate. I come from a family which my uncle was like my father, and I love my uncle to death. And my uncle was very supportive of me, and when I was in treatment 2005, on Saturdays I used to get visitors, and the first Saturday my uncle came and he said, "Jay, you broke my heart." He says, "But there's nothing I won't do for you if you want to get better." And my uncle was like my biggest supporter. He came to every medallion, my medallions, and about I'm not good with dates. About 14 years ago, he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and like I said, it runs through my family. And it was March, and the cancer just took him like that. And he didn't want to see anybody. He wanted us all to remember him the way he was. And I never got to see my uncle before he died. And the viewing, they said, my cousins and my aunt said, "Jay, we want to talk to you." And before my uncle died, he said, "You make sure you tell Jay how proud I am of him." And I got to put my 5-year medallion in his coffin. And how could I ever repay Alcoholics Anonymous? What are the words that I can say to you how grateful I am? How are the words? What are the words I can use? See, how could I ever repay Alcoholics Anonymous for what it's done for me? And here's the kicker. You never asked me to. You said, "Son, pick up somebody, bring them to detox, pick up the phone at night." Just small things for the life that I've been given today. And my uncle, like I said, this is my God shot, right? So my uncle, I belong to a group, but when it's your recovery on 1, 5, 10 years, you go up and you share your story. So and my 5 years, my uncle was he was obviously he was attending, and I'm sharing the story that I'm sharing here tonight with you guys, this morning with you guys. And so part of my amends was my other uncle, man, it's been a tough my other uncle. Like, I lost another two uncles in December, both a month apart. And my other uncle had a social club, and what I would do is I'd drive my dad to meet his brothers. That was part of the amend. I would and then I'd pick him up and take him home, and we have a conference here, the ORC. So when the ORC would come on, I would say, "Uncle Tony, can you drive my dad home?" And I would tell him we have these speakers coming in from all over the world, and it's a great day of recovery. And what happened was, after I spoke, my uncle said, "Jay," he says, "you know those conferences you're talking about?" He says, "One day you're going to be speaking in one, and I'm going to be in the front row watching." And what happened was, the first conference that I ever got asked to speak at, the place was full, and there was people along the walls, and I looked to the front, and the front seat was empty, the first seat in front of me. And I've been to many conferences, and many of those things have happened to me, and that's just God showing off. Now, I hope this doesn't sound arrogant of me, but about 3 years ago, I was asked to speak at Founders Day in the football stadium, with 10,000 people. And what happened was, and that's a testimony, not to me, of all the beautiful people that have helped me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And obviously, you start thinking of, all the people, my uncle and the people that helped me. And so before I came, I went on to speak, a lot of things were going through my mind, saying I wish, my uncle could have been here. And so I spoke, but I never talked about the chair, and I never talked really about my uncle. I just mentioned him. And what happened was, I have a friend of mine in Pittsburgh, and he said, Terry said, "Jay, would you come out here, and we're having a group anniversary. Would you come out here and speak?" And I said, "Sure." And so he said, "Jay, I got to tell you something." And he's never heard he never heard me speak. He never heard about the chair. He says, he goes, "Well, there was about 25 of us, and we're at the 50-yard line." And he said, "The weirdest thing happened." He said, "When you got up to speak," he says, "a black bird flew down on the 50-yard line, and he started to watch you." And he goes, "We've never seen anything like it." He goes, Every time you mention your uncle and God, the bird would start to sing. And he says, he did not move the whole talk. And he says, when you finished, he goes, the bird flew away singing. And do I love Alcoholics Anonymous? With all my heart, you know what I mean? And I just know that, if it wasn't for you people, I would never, ever have these opportunities that I've been given, and all I truly wanted from Alcoholics Anonymous was a good night's sleep. My mind would not shut off. I get into my car and there'd be like 20 people follow me into my car. I get into my bed and those 20 people would follow me into my bed. And every once in a while, I fall asleep and then the nightmares start. How do you sleep at night? Somebody's holding his son. Blood's coming out of his mouth. Blood's coming out of his ears with his family around him crying, please don't die. How do you sleep at night? Somebody's trying to kill you and you're running for that back door and you know what awaits for you on the other side. How do you sleep at night? The last time I got arrested, my mother was on the bottom stair here. My brother was just a baby holding on to my leg as the police were taking me out. How do you sleep at night with all those things you've done to people and all those things people have done to you? I only found one way. See, we have a singleness of purpose. We have a primary purpose, but our real purpose is to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. And I'm going to wrap it up in 3 seconds. I'm going to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me in 3 seconds. You ready? One, two, three.